There are nights when the Aetherium is as calm and peaceful as a pond on the planet Pelsinore. Nights when the big merchant ships with their cargoes of Arcturian solar crystals can expect a smooth ride. But there was a time when even the calmest night could give way to the unexpected. Pirates, the enemies of all honest spacers. And the most feared of all these pirates was the notorious Captain Nathaniel Flint. And his band of renegades would mysteriously swoop in out of nowhere. And then, gathering up their spoils, vanished without a trace. For 100 years, stories passed from spacer to spacer of Flint's secret trove, hidden somewhere at the farthest reaches of the galaxy. Stowed with riches beyond imagination, the loot of 1,000 worlds.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
As a kid, growing up on the mining planet Montressor, I lived and breathed those legends. Many a night I drifted to sleep with images of galleons, faraway planets, and Flint's gleaming trove dancing through my head. And then I turned 15.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today is the full crew of Invasion of the Remake. Sam Stepanenko is back with us today.
I have arrived. Again, I'm back. Whatever. You know, here I am.
Yeah, he had an anniversary last weekend, so we let him go be family man.
Thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. That's the magnanimous leader that I am. Now, swab those decks! Trish Cox.
That's what I did.
That's what married life is, Jay. Shut up.
Well, to be fair, here's the whole thing. He's the only one of us that can keep, well, besides other Jeff Omega, he's the only one of us that can keep a relationship alive.
Well, you know, being the founders, it's tough. We have our child right now. It is called Invasion of the Remake, yeah. Right? We're married to the podcast.
This is my longest standing relationship, just FYI.
That was Trish Coughlin, everybody. And of course, Jeff Omega is also with us today.
I be a swarthy sea dog.
Swarthy. Excellent. Go look it up. Today we're going to be talking about Treasure Planet, based on the Robert Louis Stevenson Treasure Island. This is the Disney, actually the third attempt at Treasure Island in a space format. And this was a fan challenge by Ludovarius 220. And if you have your own fan challenges, make sure you let us know through our social media or our email, invasiontheremake@gmail.com. And we will be happy to take a look if you follow the rules and let us know where to find it and if it's something we think might be worthy of this show. And this one barely hit my cutoff because I don't like to do anything past the year 2000. And this one's 2002. But since Disney's already pretty much denounced the live action of literally everything that they've ever animated, we might as well beat them to this one, right? Because it's probably a way.
Absolutely.
Off. I can't imagine it'd be any cheaper to make in live action than it took for this one.
Oh, hell no.
No.
This movie is very expensive.
Yes.
It shows, though. It's beautiful looking.
Yeah. As Jeff said, this is a very expensive film at $140 million in about 10 Whoa. Years of development. Directors Rob Clements and John Musker have been responsible for quite a few of the Disney Renaissance stuff, and this was kind of their trade-off. It's like, okay, we've done Hercules, Aladdin, Little Mermaid. We want to do this big project, so... And unfortunately, this was part of the downfall of traditional animation at Disney Studios.
Yeah. You know, I was doing a lot of reading about this because it was really interesting. Like, you know, it was a beautiful movie looking wise. Like, it has its problems, which we'll get into. But it only made like $38 million in North America. Like, that's nothing. Really does seem like, on all accounts, the heads at Disney were just done with traditional animation. Like, they were maybe trying to make it work, but I think that they were ready for it not to be around anymore. Yeah. I think they were just maintaining the studios because it was part of the legacy of the studio, but it really wasn't where their interests were, right, especially when they're getting tanked by CG movies.
Yeah, and to put this into perspective, like, this was their biggest bomb. They'd have bigger ones later on. John Carter. Not that this was a bad movie. This is not a bad movie. But the U.S. gross of 38 point something million dollars is less than the advertising budget. The advertising budget was $40 million. So it didn't even Wow. make up on its advertising. Now, it would go on to a worldwide gross of $110 million, but next to 140, that's not good.
Yeah, even accounting for DVD sales, which I was reading was roughly around 60 million all told, that only bumps that up to like 200 million, which is not even that great for a 140 million budget.
No. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, traditional animation was starting to struggle at this point, but it could have been the sci-fi aspect of Treasure Island as well, because right around the same time here, we had Titan A.E. coming out from, I think, Don mm-hmm. Bluth Studios and DreamWorks, also tanked.
Yeah, and at the time...
It's a great movie.
And a lot of pirate movies as well just couldn't... Before Pirates of the Caribbean came out and really proved that pirate movies could be popular again, any attempt that someone had at a pirate movie for a long time just tanked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was Cutthroat Islands, which was pre-2000s. That would have been... That was the death knell of Caralco.
Yeah.
It was also terrible.
Okay, well, I haven't seen it. So.
And I think the Muppets did a Treasure Island, and that wasn't one of its Muppet movies.
That was Disney's second attempt, was the Muppet Treasure Island. And then they actually did a live-action Treasure Island in 1950, if memory serves. And I have seen them all.
You know, actually, I didn't look this up beforehand, but the 1950 Treasure Island might be the first Buena Vista Studios.
Buena Vista Distribution?
Yeah, like the, you know, all those like 60s Disney movies, all of the, like, there was a heyday of live action Disney. And I think Treasure Island was either the first or really near the beginning of that.
I don't think Buena Vista actually existed until the 80s. And correct me if I'm wrong, Sam, but I think we were both around for that one.
Yeah, like, I remember the Buena Vista from the Chipmunks.
Buena Vista and Touchstone were both 80s, 90s. But I think Buena Vista's been around a little bit longer. But I don't know if it goes back as far as the 50s. I honestly don't know. Mm. I know Touchstone was like late 80s, early 90s.
Ah, well, Trisha, yeah, give us the information as if we said
it
nothing.
Buena Vista Film Distribution Company by Walt Disney. It was founded in 1953.
Holy shit. Well.
Shows what we know.
Yeah, no kidding. It really didn't seem like a prominent label until well into the 80s.
Yeah.
But that was kind of how they distributed their non-G stuff, was through Buena Vista and Touchstone. Mm-hmm. I guess these days they've got Fox. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, I don't think they ever went really past a PG. So now they've got Fox, they can put all their R stuff under the Fox banner. Yeah. So we're going to be remaking Treasure Planet as if it's a live action film. And that's going to be fun. We've done this before, and Ludo Avarius requested it because he really liked it when we did our Road to El Dorado episode. And we've done it before. We did Fire and Ice as well.
Yes.
And we've done comparisons to some of these animations to live actions like 101 Dalmatians and Beauty and the Beast, mm-hmm. just to name a couple. And we've still got plenty more that we can do.
So many more.
There's a lot of Disney movies that are animated that people are not intimate with. Let's just put it that way.
I don't know about you guys. Like, I felt like there was some really great animation here, but except in our lead character of Jim Hawkins. There's weird kind of, they almost went out of their way to be this bad boy, but I didn't like his animation designs. He kind of had his flat looking face compared to the opening scenes with his mother, which feel very classic Disney to me.
Yeah, I think that I really noticed that you can tell it's designed by the same lead designer as Tarzan. It's very much like his facial style is much more like the Tarzan kind of look than like the traditional Disney one. Like the eyes are kind of far apart. It's kind of a flat face, like minimal features.
Mm-hmm. I think for me as a style guy, it just felt like he didn't match with what was established really early on.
Or with any of the other characters in there, right? Because everybody else was really, you're right, really detailed and had a lot of sort of facial expression, and he really kind of didn't.
No, and he doesn't really even talk that much in the film, which is even weirder for the lead character.
Yeah, he is blanker. Yeah, he should have more detail to like have him kind of emote. Like you have John Silver and he's emoting all over the place with that very character face. And I feel like they could have used Joseph Gordon-Levitt more as a model and it would have worked a lot better.
Oftentimes they do use their actors as kind of character models if they've got them figured out by then. And maybe that's why he doesn't quite look right or feel right. Not to say they don't do some interesting things with the character design wise, because he's got very dark clothes and he's almost got this shadowy mask over his eyes. And as his character lightens up and he learns responsibility and he finds a new father figure with John Silver, his character lightens up too. He loses the dark jacket. That shadowy mask over his eyes goes away.
Mm, yes. I didn't notice that when I was watching it, but that's actually really true. Cool.
Yeah, well, like I own that one, so I've seen it a couple of times. It's a good double feature with Titan AE.
It would be, yeah, for sure.
I will say that Jim is probably in, you know, I think for me, I really like Treasure Planet, and I was actually surprised at how familiar a lot of the movie was to me, because I watched it. I was 9 when it came out, so I was the primary demographic for that movie. But yeah, the whole thing felt very familiar. But the core of that movie that is really the reason that it works is the relationship between Jim and Long John Silver. Mm-hmm. And I think that for him to emote more, kind of in a tough place where you have a character who's a brooding teenager who doesn't want to talk to anybody, but you still have to make him characterize, yeah. Which he does. But...
Well, I feel like the dark and brooding works a lot better in live action than it'll ever work in animation. It's
definitely.
One of the few times I think that's true.
Yeah, no, you are correct that it's, yeah, I think that was a part of why maybe it didn't work as well as it could have, is because like you have a main character that's kind of bland and hard to like get into. Like John Silver, I'm seeing a whole range of emotions. He's got a whole arc in this movie. And so John Hawkins is supposed to, but with that like kind of blank, kind of almost featureless face, you don't get anywhere. And I think in live action, you can kind of, well, it'll be better, also better written the way we're going to do it, but we can get to where we need to be with that character arc that doesn't appear to be there.
Now, I don't know if you guys have the same problem I do. I have a big problem with this movie. I mean, as much as I'm entertained by it, it is something can only exist in a cartoon world of these big galleons flying in space with nothing protecting anybody.
You know, I was really wondering about that. I was looking it up, and I think it's on the Wikipedia article in the production. It's like something, something, something that led them to create the concept of Ethereum, a galaxy filled with atmosphere. And that's interesting. It would have been nice if that was mentioned at all in the movie.
Yeah, I watched all my special features, and I don't recall much of anything being said about that either. The word Ethereum sounds familiar, so they must have, but if it's not in the movie, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Because it can exist in a fantasy context in which, you know, in this version of space, people can breathe, because that's kind of like D&D. Like, they had a module set, which was very similar in concept, with a breathable space atmosphere flying around in ships.
I do remember that. Sam, do you remember what that was called?
I honestly don't remember.
Oh, shit. That bugs me. That's going to bug me throughout this entire podcast. I guess, I guess we could, I don't know. That still bugs me. But at least it makes me feel better that the guys that floated away in Zero G probably aren't dead. They can go find them later.
That's what I thought they were dead, because in my head when I'm watching this, and I don't know, I just filled in this blank with what I thought was right, in that there was like the sails created a kind of a force field around that thing, so they technically aren't in open air. Mm-hmm. I thought there was just like an invisible force field around that they could breathe in, and that's the only way I could justify it in my head.
Well, because at the very end, he's on his solar sail in space.
Yeah.
When they go through the portal.
The little surfboard thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought he was still within that, still within the treasure planet atmosphere. So that's kind of also where I got to.
Yeah. That would work for me if that was the case. And if the ship had been in within the atmosphere, that also works for me. Yeah, I guess we can find a workaround in there. Like, I mean, solar sails exist. We could kind of have a happy medium in there somewhere. I guess we'll try to figure that out as we go. But that was the biggest hurdle for me. I'm like, if you go in live action, man, if I had trouble buying that as animation.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Right.
I know that one of the reasons, I guess, that they decided to do that was, they didn't like the idea of a bunch of characters wearing spacesuits, because it really took away from like the romanticism of the whole thing. And I agree, like, it wouldn't be the same if they were wearing masks or spacesuits, but there you could find a way to make it work, I think.
Yeah, I felt like maybe, as much as I know they really wanted to hold on to that Spanish galleon look, you might as well just do another live action adaption of Treasure Island. I mean, or do a sixth or seventh Pirates, whatever freaking number they're on at this point, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, but at the same time, how much do you lose? Like, I kind of dig like this mix of technology and a new technology and old technology that they were doing. And sometimes it was like 70-30 and sometimes it was 30-70, you know, depending on who you were looking at or what you were looking at. The ships felt like a lot of old technology mixed with new. And then you get somebody like John Silver himself, which was animation-wise very similar, not just in his style of way he looked, but he's part traditional animation as well as CGI animation, and I think the first of his kind in that regard.
Yeah, well, the whole they invented deep canvas for Tarzan, but Treasure Planet really is the first like Disney movie that implemented CG in the way that they did, where there's such a hybrid with everything. And there's parts, there's, you know, like those whales, they're completely CG. Ben is a completely CG character. Mm-hmm. And it was an expensive movie, but they really pushed the boundaries of animation, Ben.
Can we talk about Ben, the Jar Jar of the movie, right after?
Yeah.
But after we go through the trailer here, I think it's time for the Disney trailer, the classic trailer. And I like how they have the voiceovers in most classic Disney. Everybody recognizes that Disney voice, right? And this is one of those Disney classic trailers.
November 27th.
Mister, you okay in there, right?
Beware the cyborg.
This appears to be some kind of map.
This is the moment Jim Hawkins had always dreamed of.
Whoa, Treasure Planet.
Now, he's determined to go for it.
This is my chance to set things right.
I don't want to lose you.
Make you proud.
Robert Louis Stevenson's greatest adventure, Treasure Island, as it has never been seen before.
All hands to station!
Walt Disney Pictures presents Treasure Planet.
How cool is this?
What are you looking at, weirdo?
Yeah, weirdo.
Brace yourself.
Pleasure to meet you, Jimmy.
It's Jim.
And you are?
I want to say Larry.
He may be on a quest for gold.
Gonna make people see me a little different.
Mr. Silver?
Cyborg.
But he better watch out for Silver.
Change in plotline!
Pirates on my ship!
Oh, Mama.
We move now!
This isn't over yet.
Sometimes, courage can be the greatest treasure of all.
You think a pup like you can take on the likes of me?
Watch me.
Treasure Planet.
Captain Flint?
In the flesh!
Except for skin, organs, or anything that resembles flesh.
Okay, that was the trailer for Treasure Planet from 2002, written and directed by Ron Clements and John Musker, along with Rob Edwards. Rob Clements and John Musker have done things like Aladdin and Hercules, Little Mermaid, and most recently Moana, and Rob Edwards' Princess and the Frog, which I think was Disney's last fully animated feature.
Oh.
For now, hopefully they go back to it. I really hate that Disney has abandoned the thing that they do best.
I agree. I was reading actually that when Sleeping Beauty came out the first time in the 50s, it was a bomb. And it did so poorly that, well, like it was a consideration that maybe we should shut down animation at Disney. But Walt Disney, you know, he believed in the medium and he recognized that that's what his whole empire was built on. So he saw the merit in keeping it open. And yeah, it's too bad that Treasure Planet or, you know, dwindling success with subsequent movies, people made the decision that Walt Disney wouldn't have to shut down what made Disney what it is.
Yeah, and it does bother me. I mean, this movie was instrumental in the changing of the guard at Disney from the president, whose name I can't remember, to John Lasseter. So it was primarily this film that prompted that. And of course, Lasseter being more CGI and canceled a lot of sequels. This movie was planned to have a sequel. Granted, a lot of the movies like Lilo and Stitch that were getting sequels were put on the back burner or were going direct to DVD. And John Lasseter is like, hey, no, make something strong. If we're going to release a sequel, we do it in the theater.
Yeah.
And I get that.
There was a little period of time where they just seemed to just push out movies on DVD. Like there is three Cinderellas and maybe three Little Mermaids. And there's just a lot of direct to DVD Disney nonsense from that era.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a, I don't know if you can ever hear it. If you ever go to like the BBC iPlayer, and if it's ever on there, there's a comedy program. It's a two-parter by a comedian called Tom Tuck. And it's all about Disney straight to DVD movies, which he calls them STDVDs.
Hey, some of them are pretty good. I like the Aladdin ones quite a bit.
Yeah. Aladdin 3 is great.
He goes through the whole meta thing.
Lion King 1.5?
Yeah, he goes through a whole meta thing with like Lion King 1.5 and Lion King 2 is like at the end, all these characters come in and it's like, oh, and then it makes you think of Lion King 1. And then the child wants to see Lion King 1. And then after that, they go back to this one and then they go back to Lion King 1. It's like, it's just a really big, a horrible loop. He's like, you must stop this before it gets to that part or you will be locked in.
I only like Lion King 1.5 because it's basically Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why I love that. Okay, let's get into the casting of this film. Of course, these are all voice actors for this, but because it's animated, but there's going to be a lot of names you guys recognize. Joseph Gordon-Levitt was Jim Hawkins, and he's gone on to a much bigger career as he's grown as an actor from as a child actor into a modern actor. And you recognize him from Inception, Looper, and a favorite of mine when he was still a teenager, Brick. Go check out Brick. It's a hidden treasure. Sam.
By Ryan Johnson.
Yeah, Sam, I think we watched that one together. We discovered that one together.
We saw it at a screening.
Yeah, that was it. It was really good. Emma Thompson was Captain Amelia. We talked about her a couple of times. Man, I'd totally forgotten that she was in our very first episode. Sam,
well, Trish, you know this one.
Yeah, Trish was there.
What?
Yeah, you episode
very
one,
first
I Am Legend.
Episode. Yeah, she was in I Am Legend? Legend?
Yeah. I still don't remember, but
I think that she might have worked for like a human settlement at the very end of the movie.
It was uncredited too.
Yeah.
That could be why.
Yeah, when I saw that, I'm like, really? I don't know if we even mentioned her during that episode.
No,
but,
we didn't. Hey, we definitely didn't.
Go check it out. Anyway, and we, of course, last talked about her was another Disney movie in episode 150.
Beauty and the Beast.
That would be the one. Martin Short was Ben, and you can catch him in Inner Space. He's probably the most problematic character, and we will get back to him in a minute. Roscoe Lee Brown was Mr. Arrow, and another actor I'd forgotten we talked about before. He's got a great deep voice, and we talked about in episode 44.
Logan's Run.
That would be the one. Corey Burton was Onus, and most people will recognize his voice from like Transformers and G.I. Joe, the classic cartoons. But we did talk about him in episode 41.
Missed that one.
Sword and the Sorcerer. It's tough when you got voice actors because it's like the list.
He has like 410 credits.
It's insane. It is insane. Dane A. Davis was Morph, and he's like a sound effect more than anything else, but and he would be a special effect in a feature film. Most people would remember him from a couple of segments in the Animatrix movie, which is really good. Go check it out, especially with a new Matrix movie in production. Tony J was the narrator, and he was also in episode 150, Beauty and the Beast. Austin Majors was young Jim, and he was actually in a favorite horror movie of mine called Dead Silence.
Oh.
Patrick McGowan was Billy Bones, and most people would recognize him from Escape from Alcatraz and The Prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
He was wasted in this, though. You could hardly understand him anyhow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it was a very short part because he dies at the beginning of the film. And this would be his last role before he passed away in 2009, I do believe.
Yeah. Oh.
Michael McShane was Hans, and he was in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Office Space. Laurie Metcalf was Sarah Hawkins, yes. And she's obviously most famous for Roseanne. That's where everybody probably discovered Laurie Metcalf. Mm-hmm. Brian Murray was John Silver. I don't know why he's so far down the list, being a very major character. Catch him from Dreamhouse. David Hyde Pierce was Dr. Doppler, who, of course, was most famous for playing Niles on Frasier. And Michael Wincott was Scroop. We've talked about Wincott a couple of times. The first time was in episode 119.
Strange Days. Such a great film still.
Yes. And then again in episode 192.
Uncredited, though, in Ghost in the Shell.
That is it. Aww. Which is weird, because I remember him in the movie. You can spot him, so.
He's really present in the scenes that he's in.
Yeah. I mean, everybody would remember him as the villain from The Crow.
Yes.
Honestly, because he's such a creature effect, you could probably just still use him if you wanted to have him voiceover, because he was the most...
Yeah.
Human. I did.
I almost did. I didn't, but... Because I did. Honestly, I just like, hey, he's already done it. But he could easily do it again. But I was thinking when I cast him, I'm like, you know, he has got this very insect crab look. So I kind of wanted a voice that matched that a little bit more. So I kind of went a different direction with the voice work on that. But that's going to be the fun when we get to the casting of this. Now let's get to Ben here a little bit, who shows up fairly late in the movie.
Amelia looked at me and she was like, he's the Olaf of this movie.
Yeah, Olaf, yep. Jar Jar, take your pick.
Yeah.
He's, it really adds to the argument of, is Martin Short funny?
Here's the thing. he's very likable, but I think the problem I have with the Olaf Jar Jar commentary is that Olaf is legitimately endearing and Jar Jar is fucking not. So it's not the same character. It's just that happy poppy. It's weird. It's like Morph is the tiny creature that you fall in love with, and they just added another one later on. So that's what is bothersome. Morph should be that character.
Well, the thing is, like, yeah, you've got the cutesy character that the kids are going to really like. I mean, we still see that. It's in Guardians of the Galaxy, even you kind of use that as a model, really, because you've got Rocket, who's good, kids are going to just adore, and Groot on top of it all. So
I do think that it might actually be an example of how that movie was very in between in terms of culture. Animated movies in the 90s are very different from animated movies that came out in the 2000s, and I feel like Morph is much more of like a classic Disney companion sidekick character, and Ben is a lot more like the what is now modern comedy relief sidekick character.
Yeah.
It's like a cross section of both a little bit.
Well, the thing is, like, when I see a character like Ben and I really think about the movie, did he really drive the narrative in any way, shape, or form other than fill space and time?
Well, he knew the secrets behind the stuff and he gave them the information about the door. And like, I mean, in the book, he's like a dude who's stranded on a desert island, who's lost his mind, who's because he's been isolated for so long. I can feel that a little bit. But I can understand the need for that character. I just don't think it was handled very well. I would have approached it differently. It's a good character, but not handled well, I think.
I can make that argument about a lot of characters in this movie, because it feels like there's a lot of focus on set pieces and maybe some of the action pieces are just looking around at, hey, these things we construct and how cool it looks, and not driving the story enough. I mean, the John Silver stuff works, but almost barely. You know, I feel like it doesn't get the kind of time it deserves.
It's the only human connection in the whole movie. Mm-hmm. Like, cut, really.
Well, yeah.
There was a comment I read someone that made, like, at the beginning of the movie, Doppler, they kind of imply might have a thing with Jim's mom, but, you know, then he...
Might. They got married and had kids.
Oh, no, but with Jim's mom, but he ended up getting together with the captain.
Oh, yeah, Amelia, yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah. No, I know what you meant now.
Yeah, and yeah. And they didn't really seem to develop a relationship until the very... Well, until he had to save her from death, and
I think
they
Doppler
hold each other close.
Was just... He felt like... to go back to Cheers and Frasier, you know, the guy at the bar. Just a regular who would hide off in his corner, read a book. So a familiar patron more than anything else. What? So friendly. And you figure this is a village town. Everybody probably knew each other.
And you have the eccentric genius character that shows up in a lot of movies. And that was basically what he was. But it's sort of, I think the other part of it is they figured that they needed that character to drive the narrative of Jim getting on a boat, because they're like, well, he can't just get on a boat. It sort of seemed like, I thought that Doppler was supposed to pay for the crew and pay for him to be on the boat, but it seems like they get on the boat and then Jim is somehow has to work his way on the boat, which is weird.
Well, you know, I almost get the feeling Doppler, and maybe Sam will agree with me on this one, is they couldn't get away with actually putting Goofy in the movie.
I was wondering, does David Hyde Pierce feel weird to be typecast as the very smart sounding guy who isn't as smart as he thinks he is?
It's not a bad typecast to have.
He's very good at it.
No, he's definitely very good at it. And I didn't mind his character that much, to be honest. There are times where he just felt like he was getting in the way a little bit, but not by much. I felt like just it could have smoothed it out a little bit. This is one of those times where even adding, I think, 15, 20 minutes to the movie, like this would probably be really good live action just by adding a little bit of time. So it has room to breathe, especially for the personal moments. I mean, you don't want to stray too much from the Treasure Island story.
And you see, I would have actually liked to have seen a few moments like built in with Doppler and Jim, because I'm like, I don't get... We're just sort of told, oh, no, they just have known each other forever. Like, I'd like kind of a Doc and Marty McFly type of dynamic, which would be interesting, because then I could get behind these two going on an adventure together.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the characterization would be just a touch better if Doppler was, like, if they leaned a little more into the direction of how Doppler sees himself as a father figure for Jim, but Jim doesn't see Doppler as his father. And that he's always trying to, you know, like, you're not my dad. Like, you can't tell me what to do. If they maybe leaned on that a little more, you know, he's like this local kid that he's just taken a shine to, old family friend.
It just occurred to me that given the cost of this movie and how much it would cost to make it, it might be more cost effective for Disney to make this like an event series on Disney Plus, like an 8 or 10 part series.
That would be cool, actually.
Yeah, where you could spend time at the hotel that I forgot to write down, the Jim's mom, Sarah's... establishment.
Beddo Inn?
That was it, the Beddo Inn, yeah. And you can get a little more familiar with, that was the one thing I would have loved to have seen, was the recruitment of this crew. and Captain Amelia, who was not happy with the crew that was put together and how John Silver made this happen when they couldn't find Billy Bones, at least what they were looking for, the map that Billy Bones had, this orb.
And what I'd like to see is how it's kind of also some characterization with Doppler is being very naive when it comes to kind of hiring a crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in general, like being a spacer, he can be an academic with no, you know, conception of what the real world is like, which I think is kind of what his character was a little bit anyway. But I really, really like, so some of the additions that they made to Treasure Island, the story, they added, you know, they made Jim older. They made him a teenager instead of a young boy.
Yeah, he's supposed
to be
about
him losing his father.
He's supposed to be about 15, according to the special features that was cut.
So. Yeah, and I think that some people, I've seen some people when I was researching, some people really didn't like the fact that he was a teenager, and they thought it took away from Treasure Island, because part of what makes Treasure Island great is that it's a young boy. But on the other hand, you have the other camp that thinks that it's good because it adds some much needed depth to the character with him losing his father and makes his relationship with John Silver stronger.
Yeah, I didn't mind that at all, because, you know, right around that age is when kids are finding themselves as teenagers, and it's when they're pushing boundaries and rebelling. And we see all of that manifest with his rebellious nature at the beginning of the film on the surfboard. Now, another thing that's kind of triggers that unfortunately was cut, it was a good little scene that I saw. There was a little boy who saw Jim working on his little hoverboard thing or whatever, and he had like a scooter version. He's like, I can't, mine doesn't work right. And Jim was gonna go over to help him fix it, like this little moment of being able to help the youth, and then his father's like, no worries, I've got this, and waves him off. And this realization that something he never had, right?
Mm. Yeah.
It's a really touching moment that unfortunately was cut from the film, and we could put back in, and it drives that scene a little better.
And what I had is I kind of enjoyed him being sort of that little bit older, because to me, you're also balancing on the precariousness of he may go on this trip and his mother will never see him again. Like being a teenager, that's more realistic than him being a young boy. And then, because being a young boy, that's a kidnapping. But being a teenager, he might have just run off.
Now, I really like that the fact that he's a teenager. And when it came out and I was younger, I definitely didn't think at all that I didn't like the movie because the kid wasn't my age or something. Being a kid at the time, I didn't mind that at all.
With the opening with the cops hauling him back, the first thing I thought of was like, wait a minute. J.J. Abrams did that in Star Trek.
Yes.
Fucker saw this movie.
That's the first thing I thought too.
Like, do you have to rip off everything, J.J.?
You know, another thing that they added that I thought was really cool and actually a really great linchpin for the movie was when they're escaping with the map, and then Long John Silver and him are both fighting over the map, and then he grabs Morph, but then Long John Silver thinks that he has the map. That was a really great story beat and moment, and that was obviously an addition to Treasure Island because you didn't have a shape-shifting character in that book. But
what? Yeah. What's
the parrot?
Yeah, that's exactly. I was about to say the same thing, Sam. Yeah, he's the parrot. Morph is the parrot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought he was additional. That clears a lot up.
Well, obviously the shape-changing is additional.
Yeah, to give it that sci-fi aspect. But yeah, he's the parrot. Like all of these characters have parallels to the book. Like every single one of them. Doppler is two characters merged into one. They were supposed to be Jim's guardians when he went on the search for the treasure. Mm-hmm. And that's what his role is, obviously, in this too, is he's the guardian character. He's supposed to be keeping an eye on Jim. But they changed it a little bit because they made him sort of want the adventure. And then Captain Amelia is a little bit different because they made her, they gender swapped her, because obviously in Robert Louis Stevenson's time, they didn't have female ship captains. But yeah, they're all parallels.
Well, they did have some, but they were mostly pirates.
Yes. she's a legitimate captain in this case. But yeah, even Long John is just John in our movie. But yeah, even he was the cook in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do remember that. I don't remember what caused him not to get the treasure at the end. Did he die at the end of the story, or It's been so long, and I feel
yeah, I don't remember that part.
I need to revisit. I used to love Treasure Island so much, and the fact that I haven't, so I've forgotten some of it, really upsets me. Actually,
yeah, same here. Actually, when I was watching Treasure Planet the other day, I'd completely forgotten how much I like Treasure Island. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it should be required reading, I think, in grade school. It should. It's so good.
It is very good, and I'd like to see a modern remake of the 50s film, right? Like a straight up remake, not a science fiction one, but
yeah,
something to really bring it back to public consciousness that what a great story it is.
Yeah, and it's bizarre that, especially with Pirates of the Caribbean making pirates popular again, but nobody else trying to. You might have your Asylum knockoffs or whatever, but nobody really else has tried to do a really good pirate story outside of the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff, and the best pirate story out there is sitting right there. Like,
especially when so much from pirate, you know, lore and everything we know from pirates comes directly from that book, so much of it.
Yeah. Now, I guess, would you keep the aliens kind of looking the way they look in this movie? As a live action, I mean, obviously, I think Scroop's going to work really well as a special effect if you can really make him scary. But Doppler's kind of dog look, it didn't really...
Oh, that's got to go.
Yeah, it didn't work for me even in the animated film. Like I said before, I'm like, I have a feeling they just weren't allowed to use Goofy.
I was going to respond to you originally when you first mentioned it, but yes, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? It was my first response when I saw him. I was like, everybody else looks so interesting, and then there's the classic sort of Disney... tropish anthropomorphic dog, and then of course they do it with the cat as well with Captain Amelia, but she didn't look as bad or as out of place, maybe, I guess I should say.
Yeah, it actually, a lot of the alien design felt very imaginative, really, other than Doppler.
Exactly, he felt he just didn't quite fit the look. I like the idea of them kind of looking alien-ish because it gives you your sense of universe and galaxy, and one of the things that I was thinking when I was watching this, I'm like, this is the Star Wars movie we should have gotten. With the variety of aliens and the adventure that we're having.
Yeah.
Very simple. That's not what we got, obviously, but
no.
But that's kind of how I felt when I first started watching this and first started seeing the aliens.
Did you get the idea of, like, Doppler and Amelia, the cats and dogs living together? Mass hysteria. Like, there's a long way to go for a subtle joke.
But, you know, Amelia pointed out to me at the end of the movie, she was like, so they have three girls, they're cats, they have a boy, he's a dog. Are they the same species and all boys are dogs and all girls are cats?
Hey, you want me to really blow your mind?
Do it. Do it, Jay, please. I know what you're talking to say.
Oh, no. How about I leave that one to you? Because you know what I'm going to say.
Yes. Doppler is the one who had the babies.
Yes.
Oh.
But Disney felt that it was too much for a kid audience to wrap their brains around to have a male of the species giving birth, so
that's
and you know what they should, you know what they should do, we should do in our remake, is make him look really more alien, but give him a seahorsey kind of look, and then it all works.
Yeah it does.
I kind of do dig that, actually, giving it it goes back to the nautical feel, right?
Yeah. I would like to get rid of that whole they get together thing anyhow.
Yeah, it felt very tacked on, honestly.
It did. It really felt unnecessary. Like, it didn't feed the story at all.
It didn't feed the story. Like, what I would do is I would kind of keep it, but it would be more that, like, Doppler is just not, he doesn't belong where he is. And it seems like being out with the captain, he's more in his element, like actually being in space as opposed to just studying it.
No, and I love the bit where it turns out that he's actually a crack shot, even though he's never fired a gun before. I found that hugely entertaining.
Yeah.
Like, that was a great line.
There's little notes that are hints of what could be explored, and they don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, if we go with the miniseries format, I think I would keep the subplot of maybe the romance, but you draw that out more and just keep it kind of cute in the background where he's infatuated and she doesn't give two shits that he's infatuated.
See, I like that better without, like we said, shoehorning in this that they get together kind of thing.
Yeah. It's only when he actually does something a little more heroic where she actually starts paying attention to him, even in the film. So that's something you can draw out a little bit more if you wanted to, either in a live action film with an extra time or in a miniseries format, which I think is probably more likely as a remake, because, man, how much money is Disney going to dump into this a second time?
Yeah.
And And what I liked is it wasn't so much he was doing something heroic where I first saw the hint of it, is when he's like, there will be another burst in like 47.2 seconds. She's like, oh, great, I can put up the sails. Like, becomes a whole teamwork thing that I liked, where she kind of notices and she's like, oh, no, you're very useful if you give me the right information. We work together very well.
Yeah. I wanted to do more with Mr. Arrow as well before he was shunted out in space, this right-hand man to Amelia that is a really cool-looking character, this big stone guy that is clearly a threat to John Silver and his crew, but we don't see enough of that to motivate his being shunted into space.
Well, when it happened, I wrote down, oh no, not Mr. Arrow, because I didn't feel I had enough time with him.
Yeah.
He's also a plot hole, because if Ethereum,
they can breathe
in it, they could have gone back and got him.
Yeah.
Yeah. True.
But do you think it's because that was that black hole thing was the problem?
Yeah, that's right. He got sucked into the black hole.
And if it was like an explosion launched them out, so he probably got burnt alive. Oh, God.
In terms of like a villain killing a character in a Disney movie, that whole part was handled really well. Like you really felt that, you know, during all of the chaos that he could get away with it. And it was a really good story beat. It was a really good moment of, man, I didn't expect the villains to get a leg up, and John Silver is supposed to be on their side, but it's just, yeah, it adds interesting complications to the story.
It also motivates the most important scene in the film, where he sees the effect it's had on Jim, when Jim was responsible for securing everybody's safety lines, and he takes that responsibility onto himself. It's like, I got somebody killed. And then John Silver gets that great father figure moment of, this isn't your fault, like, you, I see greatness in you, lad. And it was really
a good scene.
Yeah, it was probably my favorite scene in the whole movie.
Well, yeah, because it gives John depth, right? Because even in the original book, he's not a bad guy, he just has a singular goal.
Yeah.
Whereas Scroop, he's the actual bad guy throughout the whole movie. He's the one who's got malicious intent. He revels in doing bad things.
Yeah, he's greedy and selfish and is violent. He doesn't care who he has to kill and step through to get what he wants.
And with John Silver, like, you can tell part of what John Silver has to do is be very kind of violent and overbearing to Scroop, because he will not respond to anything else, and he will try to undermine him whenever he can.
Yeah, and when it came down to who the two big tough guys on the ship were, it would have been Mr. Arrow and Scroop. It's funny, they both met the same fate. Although Scroop could still be floating out there if you can breathe in Ethereum. He could still be out there. Unless he succumbed to the collapse of the planet.
Well, it's a dark way to go when you think about it. Yeah, you're out there breathing, but then you just kind of slowly dehydrate and starve to death.
Yeah. Well, he was a mollusk, so...
It takes longer, so it's worse.
It's much worse.
I don't feel sorry for him at all.
No, he was a bad guy. Didn't feel sorry for him at all. You're like, oh, that was it. He was probably pretty tasty if you boiled him.
Oh,
I just kept looking at him. I'm like, oh, I really want crab or lobster for dinner. But Jay, he's a bottom feeder. I'm like, yeah, they're the tastiest ones.
See, but the way he had like his thorax was, it reminded me more of a spider. And that's what I found terrifying.
Yeah, especially when he's descending on him in the hallway. It really reminded me of the scene in Return of the King with Shelob, like in her den, the way that, you know, the spider like moved around and stalking its prey and stuff.
Uh-huh. And that's a great thing we could do with live action, is have him skidding around and on walls and roofs and webs and things like that, and setting traps even with his webs. Like, he could be a real threat, and you can darken it up and still keep it a PG-13.
Well, and we should do more with him like they did in the book, because he was undermining John in the book. Right, he had his own sort of little faction of John's crew, or John's team, or band of pirates, whatever you want to call them, who he was gathering together as sort of a sub team, just in case things didn't go the way he wanted them to.
It was a mutiny within a mutiny.
Yeah, it was.
It's the Russian nesting doll of piracy.
Yeah, and that wasn't really apparent in this movie that he was doing that.
Yeah.
And I think
it's
that's
Inception
just
Inception piracy.
That's nice throwback to Joseph Gordon-Levitt there.
Yep.
And that, given more time, we can see like that. And I think grabbing a little more of that Treasure Island story and throwing into this scenario is only going to help the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it should have been probably Silver rather than Hawkins that takes out Scroop, but that might go against the story.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I think that a novel really benefits from in terms of the original Treasure Island that a series would also would is the sense of time traveling from one place to another on a ship. And if you were to do that in a series, their journey would feel a lot more like a journey than over the span of a movie.
And when he opens the map and Doppler was like looking, is like, there's that and that and that, like those beats can be in the show. Like it can be part of where
it
you
stops
go from
along
A to
the
B.
Way.
Yeah.
Little hints of like, okay, this is where you go. This is, and this is the stop off here. And this gets you here. And maybe you need a key to get here, and becomes more of a quest if you go with the series format.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we can get rid of the stupid montage where they're scraping space barnacles off the bottom of the ship.
Yeah, you know what? That montage bugged me too. I'm like, yes, I guess you paid for that Goo Goo Dolls song, so you needed to use it. And it saves time because kids have a short attention span. But if you're going to have those bonding moments, have the bonding moments. I think the flashbacks with his father should have happened right at the beginning of the movie in a very Up style where you're really like, oh, that's terrible. What happened to poor Jim as a child? Losing his father in that regard. And if you establish that early and see you understand the rebellious nature much quicker as well if you move it back to the beginning of the film. Well,
you know what? I like the barnacles on the ship, but I want them to be like alien egg pod thingies.
Yeah, they shouldn't be barnacles in space. But what were you going to say, Sam?
I want them the facehuggers.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Sam?
I was going to say, yeah, and if you sort of reinforce that rebelliousness of him, that can be part of what draws John to him in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Is he sees a lot of himself in there. So he finds this kindred spirit in this young man who he sees a lot of potential in, and it changes him. And that's part of what happens in this movie, but it's not particularly well handled, how they change each other. You see his effect on Jim, but you don't see Jim's effect on him as much, except for at the very end.
Mm-hmm. See, I was seeing it throughout when he's like Jim takes him out in the longboat and they go into like the tail of that meteor. And he's like, holy crap, like you see... I saw that more, Jim's effect more on Long John than Long John's effect on Jim in the movie. That's weird, like, because that's how I saw it. But you saw
it. Yeah, and there are moments of it, you're right. On the whole, though, that montage could have been better served by really reinforcing their effect on each other.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the point I was trying to make.
Totally. Yeah, that they needed to have it more even.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, with montages too, montages you use when you need to when you need to have a space of time that a character needs to get something done, but you don't have the amount of time to tell it. And that's not a problem we would have if we did a series.
Yeah, we don't do the series option very often, but it's, I think that speaks to our love of the source material. That we just want to spend more time with it.
And I do think that the design and generally a lot of what went into Treasure Planet, I do like and would like to see more of. If it had worked out that way, I would watch more Treasure Planet material.
And, you know, science fiction seems to work better for television as a whole.
Mm.
These days, you don't get a lot of sci-fi films unless they're big franchise films.
Yeah, because you need long-format storytelling for sci-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I would like to do as well is, like, if you have the long format, you can kind of, pun intended, expand the universe. You could have those stories, like, we were talking about, like, she's a captain of a ship, and that's not normal. But, like, there were female pirates, and to have, like, maybe just them coming upon another band of pirates, like a Nellie Bly type of deal, where they would have that bit of interaction, at least at one of their stops, right?
Well, the story...
long format.
Yeah, the story lends itself very well to the space opera format.
Yeah.
So that would be great to start throwing little Easter eggs like that in there. It's like, well, we don't have to do just this pirate.
Or the lady, there's a Chinese pirate, and she had like a ton of ships. She brought China to its knees.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. She had like 60,000 ships. So she commanded a fleet.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Pirates of the Caribbean, why haven't you done that yet?
Yeah.
She just basically, they went after her and then she kicked their ass. And then at the end, she just told China, like, yeah, I'm just retiring and you're just going to give me a title and everything's fine, right? And they just did.
Amazing.
It's like either that or kick your ass again.
Right? And that was exactly it. They're like, well, okay, if you promise to retire, sure.
And that'd be some fun stuff to put in there. And,
yeah.
This maybe the thought of this map has gotten out there and Silver's going after it, but he's not the only one after it.
And yeah.
That would be a good way to drive a series.
Obviously, yeah, especially because it is a legendary treasure.
Yeah. It's a whole planet.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of the movie, is the fact that the real treasure really isn't even all of the booty. It's the planet itself.
Yes.
Is really the treasure, because it allows them to travel anywhere in the universe instantaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the value of that. Just
and
the
that's where I'd like to focus.
Yeah, the commerce of being able to go anywhere you want, and the technology. The yeah, because that story that they're telling, the storybook story of Captain Flint using this, yeah, which wound up being a true story within the mythology of this movie, is Captain mm-hmm. Flint used that portal to conduct his piracy, to go get his booty, and then yeah, disappear like the winds. So this legend of Captain Flint exists in the first place. So now if you think bigger,
yeah,
that's a lot. Or if you could even relocate that and maybe make the planet that Hawkins is from, and suddenly Sarah, her little inn becomes this major spaceport.
Oh, well, I have this whole idea that it's like, it's Hawkins Doppler travel.
And well, they just, I was thinking about that, and that's how we can fix Ben.
Oh, go for that. We definitely need to fix Ben. So
yeah, so I like the idea of having part of his memory pulled, and that's, he holds the key to building that technology.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Right? So that he can make him less annoying, but he has gaps in his memory. Anything to do with Flint specifically is missing, including the plans for the portal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yes. So you can tone down the goofiness of him, still make him relevant, because he is relevant and because he is an integral part of the original story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he is on Flint's Island. He was left behind by Flint to guard the treasure.
Right.
And what I still think is, you need to kind of lean into like the isolation madness, like not yeah, as comic as, relief, but
well, because Ben was mad from being left alone on the island. Absolutely. So, yeah. So yeah, you can certainly incorporate that without making it quite so over the top.
Well, if yeah, he was a guard, then you would figure he was at least some sort of capable soldier, or at least in his programming, and we could change him design-wise. One thing that the movie hinted at, when he kind of went down on his knees, he's got these wheels and gears, and I'm like, I felt like he could just fold into something a little more compact and roly. And I'm like, man, he kind of reminds me of a cross between a Star Wars pit droid and Wally in the way he looked. Now, if you could add a little bit more of a military feel to that, that would be kind of cool.
I like that, actually. And it fits really well into the idea of him being the repository of all that information.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can still have that great moment of the planet self-destructing, but all the information is still available to rebuild it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then it goes to what Trish was saying, was making Jim's planet the first hub of this new network of portals.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then whoever who was the guy who was in Deep Space Nine, he just shows up one day. We could just have a crossover.
Yeah, and this would be great, because, I mean, you still have John Silver out there somewhere, and you have a good ending for Sarah, who loses her in at the beginning of the movie. It's lit on fire and stuff. So by John and his men. And John does give what little he still has, because he didn't get away with his treasure planet and all of the booty. So he gives what little he has to rebuild Sarah's inn. But to get something like this would be quite something.
Yeah. And I have to,
go for it.
Go ahead, Jay.
You had a much bigger gasp than I did.
So what if there is no treasure when they get there?
Mm.
Because the whole idea of it being gold and silver and jewels just didn't fit into the space theme for me.
Right.
Yeah. See,
what I thought was when they got and they showed the whole portal, in my head, I'm like, oh, this is the treasure. It never even occurred to me there was some physical treasure.
It does feel like you should lean more into the metaphor of treasure. Yeah, okay, if this, you could still have that stuff, but the real value isn't that treasure. Like Captain Flint didn't see it either. You know, he used it to steal valuables. but yeah. It's invaluable with the technology actually had.
You could make so much more money just by sharing that technology and using it for industry. Mm-hmm. So, right. But it's, they don't see it in the practical terms. They see it how that can benefit them, which is indicative of the type of people they are.
Yeah. Thinking small.
So yeah, but like I said, there could be like a treasure, but it's not what John thinks it's going to be. Mm-hmm. It could be goods and stuff like that, that Flint thought were valuable versus like tangible gold.
Right? And speaking of the thinking small thing too, I mean, you just grab the gold and you hoard it. What fucking good is that?
That's a question I've always had.
Right? Yeah. I don't understand.
If only we had a Ouija board and a desire to contact some pirates.
Well, that's a classic story of that greed, that sickness of greed getting the better of you. And that's the best part of seeing Silver turn away from that to save Jim. So I think we still need that. It would be kind of cool if, as much as I'd like to give the technology to Sarah, it'd be kind of cool if he did get away with none of the treasure, but did get away with the technology and resumed his piracy the same way Flint would and became a legendary pirate.
Yeah.
Both endings I would be quite happy with.
You know, I almost feel like it's like they should have like the treasure, all the gold. It's almost like that should be there to distract people from the real treasure, which is the portal. It's like all of that. But yeah, it doesn't matter. It's a red herring.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about it, like he does get away with it, but you have like Ben who can help rebuild the portal. But perhaps what John Silver has on him is the map. He somehow manages to get a hold of that before they go through the portal. And he's just got that with him in order to reverse engineer it. Like what you're saying is he's got access to a portal.
I like that.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, I dig that too. Yeah.
Awesome.
Cool. All right, well, and I mean, the structure of a classic story like Treasure Island, we're not going to be able to improve that on that too much, but smoothing out some of the flaws of this movie and adding some of the more sci-fi elements to it, I think worked really well. And
I had one more thing I was wondering about. I know we discussed kind of like ships and how they don't make sense because like the space is like the ether. Mm-hmm. So are we going to like go make a mixture of like a steampunk spaceship where some of it is manual and some of it is like super sci-fi?
Yeah, I actually wrote that down in my notes of it because it already feels like a steampunk sci-fi to me anyway. Uh-huh. So we could lean into that a little bit more, but at the same time, steampunk has not been something that's worked out in film.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of, Firefly, as a fad, it's died down a lot.
That's true. Firefly has done it with the Western theme. So I think it just...
That's space Western, though. It's different. It's like the look a little is different.
And when you're talking about like the solar sails, those are like a real thing. And I think they should be in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's just my two cents.
You know, when I first... like sort of saw this, the sort of galleon style ships in the film, I'm like, you know, that's like leaning into it a little bit too hard. But as I watched it, and I did enjoy it, and it's a lot of it's kind of critical to the story. Like when we lose Mr. Arrow, you have to have the open decks. We have to figure a way to make that work in order for some of those key elements to continue to work in the in a film, right? Because the open decks do play a part of the character.
Do you think the masts themselves would like project a protective force field? Because you have to be able to take the sails down at some point.
Yeah, there's got to be some sort of like either we sort of keep the Ethereum and explain it better.
Well, if this is kind of, you're using fantasy aspects as well in this regard, but if all you do need to do is establish this galaxy exists this way, where the entire galaxy has an atmosphere, if you establish it early, then you're fine. But that's something the movie does not do. So,
and that's the point. Exactly the point I'm trying to make.
If we establish that early on and how this universe works, then we're fine and we can stick with the galleons and the mix and of technology and the steampunkiness of it all.
Oh. I almost feel like at the very beginning of the movie, when he's using his like snowboard, like solar sail type thing, I almost feel like that's the part of the movie where he should be trying to get into space with it.
Yes.
To see if
that's
he can.
Exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah.
And then you can get that Ethereum thing established and discuss it around that point.
Exactly. And you could have a lot of fun with the idea of a galaxy that is atmosphere because it changes the way you travel.
Yeah.
Right? Because you have heat and all these scientific things about physics and energy and stuff like that that you could really play up on
and how would,
in a longer format.
Yeah, and how would weather without gravity affecting it be in something like this? Because once you have atmosphere, then you have oxygen and chemical reactions and weather in space. Like, raining nowhere.
Well, yeah, like, just have, there's a
Actual space, you have clouds of moisture that exist.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be going through that would be something you could
that do. Would, and visually, that would look really cool.
Yeah, yes. And that could be a more interesting way to sort of lose Mr. Arrow rather than the black hole, which they would not have escaped from.
Yeah. Like, no. Especially with that extra beat. Yeah. Especially with that extra beat where they get sucked into the black hole. There's a good 2 or 3 seconds where they're just in a black hole. A little bit too long for me. I didn't quite believe that at all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but a space weather, a space hurricane might be a better way to handle that without putting the ship quite as at risk.
Yeah.
Because for a movie that doesn't really care a lot about science, that was a part of the movie that it was a really cool part of the movie. But to have a bunch of science-y type stuff in a movie where they're actively ignoring stuff from science, like breathing an atmosphere and stuff, it is a little strange.
Yeah, it felt like too much with the black hole. Like, wouldn't you have saved that for the ending rather than like a solar storm would have been enough, right? You already had a collapsing star. It's like, oh no, and now it's they were going to die when it collapsed, and now it's become a black hole, which actually saved them. Like, it's all a bit much. And it's actually bigger than your climax of your film.
Ooh, and you don't have to lose Mr. Arrow either. Like, you could have him, like, kind of adrift, and it, like a boat comes by. They're like, man, over, like when you're in the ocean. Like,
that would be really cool to play with. Like, if atmosphere exists in space, totally. Like, why not have somebody be discovered who's been floating out there?
Oh, he gets picked up by some of our other pirates who are following them.
That'd be cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's an awesome idea.
I mean, give him his little story, too, as he takes over from the crew.
And Scroob is a post-credit sequence where he's just laying out there.
Yeah, you know, I do think that Treasure Planet is the type of movie where it has problems, but instead of trying to, you know, do away with things that we see as problems, turn them into creative opportunities. And all of a sudden, there's so much interesting material to deal with.
Yeah.
Well, especially if we're looking sort of at a long format, you want more characters and more stories to sort of be happening.
Yeah.
Well, I think what we decided and discovered that the problem was is that it had all these ideas, but it didn't delve into any of them. So it's not taking stuff out. It's the fact that stuff was missing, which seems largely the problem.
Well, we've got lots of probably more ideas we could add to this as a series, if it's a series. But let's add to the cast. We got to get into some live action casting here. And that's some of the more fun aspects of doing an animation to live action as well. So, Jeff, why don't you start us off here?
So with Jim, I thought about it a lot. And initially, I was thinking KJ Apa from Riverdale. But I think he's a little too old, and I don't want this to be a story about someone who's in their early 20s. Like, the fact that he is still a kid and an adolescent is really important to me for that story. So I feel like that's specifically a role that, you know, you would just hold thousands of auditions for or something to find, because I don't really know of a lot of under 18-year-old actors currently, and just because there are some doesn't mean that we always have to go back to them all the time. Like, Tom Holland doesn't need to star in everything.
Yeah, well, and he can't pull off 15 anymore anyway.
No. but I do think that for Long John Silver, I was thinking of Brendan Gleeson.
I can still totally see a Brendan Gleeson in this role. It'd be very similar to his Harry Potter role in a lot of respects.
Yeah, because he was Mad-Eye Moody.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's a really good actor, and I thought of Benicio del Toro, I thought of a lot of different people, but he really has that quality of being kind of gruff and being likable, but at the same time, he could turn on you and be a villain. In keeping in line with Treasure Planet, I feel like they wanted people to see Long John Silver more as a character than the actor playing him. And I think that's a way you could cast him without people being distracted by who's playing him.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking the spider lobster guy.
Scroop.
Scroop. Yes, thank you. So I was thinking for Scroop, actually, I think Willem Dafoe would be a great voice for that character.
Yes, he is.
Which is funny because Willem Dafoe is supposed to be the villain of Treasure Planet, the sequel that never got made.
Oh.
But yeah, he would be great for that sort of character. And he has a really, really good voice for something that looks like that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that otherwise, for Mr. Arrow, I would probably go with... This might sound strange, but I might go for... I don't know, like maybe like a wrestler. Does that sound weird to go for like a, you know, like a Batista, but not Batista. Like there's a lot of wrestlers who are getting into acting.
Voices. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gravelly voices and huge, lots of muscles. And they're going to be under tons of makeup anyway.
Or mocap.
Yeah.
Or mocap. Oh yeah. Good. Good thinking there. I didn't even think about the mocap. That's about as far as I got with my casting, but I mostly was really excited because I think that Ron Howard would be a good director. Only because, I mean, you know, Ron Howard, I don't need to tell people who Ron Howard is, but what made me think he'd be perfect for it was I really, really liked what he did with Solo and how he tied that all together and the sense of adventure that movie had. Mm-hmm. And I know that he had a really, really fun time making it. And when he was making it, you know, he talked about how it was bringing him back to his, like, his roots making chase movies with Roger Corman, and he like felt really excited making it, and he really wanted to do a sequel where he was involved from a Star Wars movie from the beginning of production rather than coming in after someone else had made some decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And Solo, I don't think a sequel is going to happen.
Yeah.
Treasure Planet would be a really good type movie for him to tackle, to do something similar.
Yeah. Oh, hopefully he gets his Star Wars wish, but yeah, I agree with you on that one. That's a good choice. He's clearly can wrap his brain around on that kind of stuff. And we've even covered Ron Howard in one of those Roger Corman chase movies. So
yeah, and he, you know, he did In the Heart of the Sea a couple years ago, which was you know, a ship movie. Yeah. You know, about the people about the story that inspired Moby Dick. So it's not like he's unfamiliar with sci-fi or you know, the high seas.
Yeah, I think he'd be very respectful to Robert Louis Stevenson on that one. Trish, why don't you go next here?
Okay. What I did is Jim Hawkins. I cast Ki Hong Lee from The Maze Runner. He might be a bit older now, but I'm thinking of him as he's like younger in The Maze Runner. It's one of those ones, like Jeff was saying, it's really hard to cast like a 16-year-old because they're not that age forever. And it's just, it's so tough to find them, the right person.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe an open casting call for that. For Sally Hawkins, I went with Constance Wu because I just love her.
Sarah Hawkins.
Yeah.
You said it's Sally Hawkins. She could just play
Sally
herself.
Sally Hawkins. Sarah Hawkins? Okay. And then for Dr. Doppler, I went with Doug Jones because so many times Doug Jones has done the acting for David Hyde Pierce. So now I'm just replacing David Hyde Pierce's part with
Justice.
Doug Jones.
Justice.
Yes, justice for Doug Jones.
And considering how he likes playing aliens.
Yeah. I mean, it totally works. And he can use his own voice this time. Yes. It's all him.
Yeah, he's got a great voice. When he did the Hellboy cartoons that they did, they used Doug Jones's voice back in there. And he was, in my mind, he is a far better voice for Abe Sapien than David Hyde Pierce was.
He's got a fun voice. I don't know what the deal was. Like, yeah, use him.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And for Captain Amelia, I put Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She's like kind of another Emma Thompson. She's a very prolific writer and actress, and she's been in Fleabag, but she's also like, she's doing writing on the Bond movies. Mm-hmm. So I thought she'd be like a good fit for it.
Cool.
And for Mr. Arrow, I almost changed this after he died, but then I thought, no, I'm upset because I wanted more time with Mr. Arrow. And I went with Brendan Fraser because I thought he's kind of having a renaissance right now. And I would like to see him in like this character. As we've decided, maybe he doesn't die. I'm on board with this.
I actually thought you might go with him as Ben since he's playing robots lately.
I have quite an interesting Ben. And then for Mr. Silver, I have Ramon Tikaram, and he's a British actor, and he's Terrence McCann on Brassic, so he can play mean and intimidating, but he was also in like Man Down, where he can play comedy as well and like just an easygoingness. So, and he's not a big man, he's a smaller man. So I think it's interesting to play with the fact of like keeping all these guys in line when you're not like this huge beast of a guy. And then I actually, they had the narrator cast, I put Keith David, because I think there should be a bit of a narrator portion in certain spots of this.
Yeah, I didn't think about doing the narrator, but that's a good one if you're going to do it.
Exactly. And Mr. Scroob, I have Ed Skrein, who was Francis in Deadpool, because when I looked at the hair, I kept thinking of what the character he played in Game of Thrones, which had long, luxurious hair. So just put his face on like a spider lobster, and there you go.
That was a weird way of thinking of it.
Are you kidding? The whole problem I'm going to have with this casting is I'm going to find this sexually attractive, and there's going to be a lot of weird shit going on. That's where I went with it.
I don't know what that is.
Well, I'm afraid of spiders. Yeah. I'm terrified of spiders, but I think Ed Skrein is hot. It's going to be very complicated. We're going to have a very complicated relationship. And then for Ben, I had Patton Oswalt.
Nice.
Because I think he's quite good. He can do both like light and dark.
Right.
And then I went another way too with Flint. I had it because this reminded me so much of the Goonies. I just wanted something of like a CGI, just like Flint message, but done by Sean Astin.
Oh.
I just want to shoehorn him in there somewhere.
You went deeper than me because I didn't actually even do Flint. So,
I only did this because I'm like, Sean Astin has to be a Goonie Easter egg. And then for my director, I went with Patty Jenkins because when I think about a Wonder Woman, you have the Poison Lady and she's very steampunk. And then how she recreates the vastness of old London and like the different areas of like the Isle at Themyscira, and she has stuff on boats. Like I think she could do this and it would be very interesting.
The best part is if this is a series, we can use all of our directors at some point.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's
awesome.
Yes, very true.
And that's everything I got.
And mix and max the cast. Well, that's a good cast. All right. I'm really looking forward. Sam, what do you got here?
Okay. So as always, anybody under the age of 20 is tough to cast, as we've already said. But I went with Chandler Riggs because he still looks like he's at that late teenage level.
Chandler Riggs. Is he?
Walking Dead.
Yeah, the Walking Dead?
He played Rick's son.
Rick. Okay.
He's Carl, I think. Carl.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so Carl. So he might be right on the cusp there, but yeah, he was felt right to me there.
I thought about it because I've been watching a lot of Walking Dead lately since I tapped out around season 4, and now I've watched season 5 and amidst of season 6 right now. So he was definitely on my brain.
Yeah, and he was like the first one that popped in my head, but he's the closest one to the age we would need.
And he'd be capable of leading a film at this point with how long that series has been going.
Exactly. For my Dr. Doppler, like as soon as he popped on screen, a name popped into my head. I couldn't help thinking of Stanley Tucci in The Hunger Games.
That's so good.
Yeah, and it just stayed. I'm like, nope, it's got to be Stanley Tucci.
I like it.
for my John Silver, interestingly enough, Trish and I were kind of on the same thought pattern for this. While we were thinking about our casting, because I actually went with Keith David as John Silver, because he's a fairly imposing man. He's older now, but I think that he would be really good at sort of that juxtaposition of the kindness of John versus the need for it to be the leader and the obsessiveness of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For my Captain Amelia, I went with an actress who's capable of physical action as well. Somebody who's done it very well for quite a while, but she's also now a little bit older because she would be a little bit older as a captain of a ship. So I went with Kate Beckinsale.
Oh, nice. Mm.
I think she has the body type to play sort of that feline character. For my Scroop, I actually had two because I did sort of default to Michael Wincott because he was so good as like, and as far as voice goes, he's just perfect. But I also considered Benicio del Toro. Again, same sort of thought pattern as Jeff, just for a different character.
Yeah.
For my Mr. Arrow, I went with Tony Todd because I wanted somebody who has sort of that really rumbly voice Stone character. And, I mean, he could do the mocap because he's a big man.
I think all of us were kind of thinking on similar grounds.
Yeah. For my Ben, I went with Steve Carroll because he can do the slightly goofy comedy. Or he can do really goofy comedy if he needs to. But he can also do really serious. I mean, when you see, if you've not seen Fletchcatcher, you should because he is so good in that. Playing sort of the slightly mad character, and that would be sort of where we were going with Ben and is slightly mad without going over the top with it. And then I didn't cast Sarah Hawkins because at the time she was kind of a minor character.
But as we've pointed out, Sally Hawkins would be perfect.
Yes, yeah, she would. Actually, she would be perfect.
Sally Hawkins would be perfect for Sarah Hawkins.
And then for my director, I went with Brad Bird. He directed Iron Giant and Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. So mm-hmm. I thought he could sort of capture the sci-fi and might have fun sort of doing the animation to live action. And we know he can do action because he's done things like Ghost Protocol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's very good. Man, this is going to be a tough one because everybody's got spectacular casts. Okay. Well, I'm just like everybody else. I struggled with Jim Hawkins casting somebody 15. But with a lot of research, I came up with Dylan Schmid, who was in 1922 and Snowpiercer. So he's a child actor. He's around 17 now, so he's just in that magic spot. So we'd have to start shooting right now. Otherwise, hello, casting director. Start making calls. For his mother, I went with Michelle Monaghan as Sarah Hawkins. And she was in, actually speaking of Mission Impossible, she was in the third one and eventually marries Tom Cruise's character and makes small appearances in follow-up film. She was in Gone Baby Gone and Constantine. For John Silver, and I did this completely by accident, not having read up on the movie yet, because I thought the character of John Silver looked like this actor, Jim Broadbent. And then I read he was actually considered for the part.
Oh, cool.
So apparently I was like, hey, I see it. I totally see it.
Yeah.
For Captain Amelia, I went with Cate Blanchett.
Nice.
For Mr. Arrow, again, wanted big imposing with a big gravelly voice. I went with Kevin Grievous. He played Reyes in the Underworld movies, a big towering black werewolf guy. Really deep, deep voice. So we were all kind of on the same page with that. It's amazing we didn't have a crossover on that. And all found different people to do that. For Dr. Doppler, I kept thinking of that prim and proper, who was kind of goofy, who could do a little weird. And I went with Jude Law.
Nice.
Yeah.
For Scroop, and I was thinking more voice work, and I wanted to not feel creepy, but it didn't have to be as deep as it was. Even though Wincott, I would more than welcome him back if he wanted to play that part again. I went with Crispin Glover.
Nice.
Very nice.
Add a little creep to it, right? And I almost didn't do Ben because I hated him so much, but then something kicked into my brain. I'm like, oh, I want that. I don't know why I want that, but I want that so much. So I went with Bill Moseley. Just let
that's
it.
That's fun, actually.
Yeah, just let it sink
Wait,
in
Bill
for
Bill Moseley again.
Bill Moseley, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, oh, House of a Thousand Corpses.
Yes, that took me a second. I'm like, I should know that name, but it's not coming anywhere.
That's perfect. The whole time with Ben, I had a really hard time, and I couldn't decide on somebody because even though it didn't play this way in the movie, I wanted somebody who could have any twinge of age to their voice because the character is so old. And yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah, there's something about it when I came across my just popped in my brain for no reason. I was going to completely leave him out, and I'm like, oh, I want this. I want this so much.
Oh, I'm just hearing like Otis talking.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yes,
with a little mechanical twinge. I was so happy.
And now I'm seeing him show them around his little house and being like, there's just a chainsaw there. And he like moves it like, never mind this.
Home protection.
I never get visitors.
Anymore.
I was going to say, I just hear him saying, motherfucker.
The door is closing, motherfucker.
Yeah, considering all the dark shit in his library, to put him on a Disney project, we quite something. And for a director, I'd actually forgotten until just like a couple minutes ago, so I scrambled and I went with Doug Liman, director of Edge of Tomorrow.
Cool choice.
Another great science fiction film.
He's a really interesting director. I think that he'll be one to watch.
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping he'll do more science fiction. We don't have a lot of really distinct science fiction voices right now, and I'm kind of hoping, like, there's clearly guys out there who are doing it and doing it well. So I'm kind of hoping we'll go through the renaissance that horror is going through right now, and we'll start seeing some more of those guys be able to push out some of their ideas onto film. It would be really great to see. And God knows we need some awesome escapism right now, and this might fit the bill. Who knows?
Yeah, I would think so. And actually, one of the names that came across in my sort of my brain, because I'm a huge fan, is Duncan Jones, because he does such great science fiction. Mm-hmm. Right? If you want to talk about a sort of modern voice of it, I think he could very well be that voice.
Yeah.
You pair him up with like JJ, and you might have something really, really spectacular.
Yeah. And another Neil Blomkamp, who's been great at science fiction throughout his career. So they're out there. They're definitely out there.
You know, if there was a time for Disney to do a live action remake, you know, people are enjoying the Star Wars TV shows. If as soon as the little fallen out of favor is gone away a little bit from the last couple of movies from a lot of people, I think that right now a Star Wars-esque movie from Disney who also makes Star Wars would actually do surprisingly well.
Mm-hmm. So I did say sort of like as I was watching this, this felt like the Star Wars film that we didn't get in a lot of ways.
Well, at least, you know, as much as that last trilogy kind of wore me down, Mandalorian won me back. So there's still room.
I like the last trilogy, but compared to the trilogy before it, it was much better than the prequel by yards and yards. But this reminded me actually more about... Sorry?
Yeah, I don't know. They're about the same.
No, they are not even close. Some of the bullshit that was in those prequels, like fucking hell.
You know,
garbage in there.
We could have a podcast just talking about this topic alone.
Yes, we could.
I know. But the Mandalorian, suck my dick. I'm sorry.
But we're not, and we're not going to do it now. Thank you, Ludo Avarius, for recommending Treasure Planet as part of our remake, and you too can have your suggestions, your corrections, and your comments. You can make all of those at our social media, at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake at Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion the Remake at gmail.com. And of course, we're looking for fan challenges. If you've got something interesting that might fit the bill, we like a little odd, a little weird, and of course, challenging, but accessible. So let us know where you can find it as well. And we might consider it as a future episode like we did with Treasure Planet. And I even broke my rule of not doing anything after the year 2000. So if it's good enough, we'll do it.
Considering it's 20 years ago.
It's 18. It's close. Right, yeah, I did a little bit. For the most part, I mean, I don't want to break 2000. So
basically,
or keep it on the cusp if you're going to.
If the movie is old enough to vote, we'll consider it.
That's right.
Yeah.
This movie is a voting age, so.
Exactly.
But still can't go to the bar in some states.
This reminds me actually a lot more of that movie Ice Pirates that we did so many episodes ago, where you're searching for this special place, and for them it was water, and for this one it's like gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting you brought that up, because I was actually doing a mental comparison of it myself while I was watching it.
Yeah, I didn't think about it. We've done
more like that.
Now we've done two sci-fi pirate movies.
Yeah.
And one thing we haven't mentioned, or maybe I missed it at some point there, but we didn't talk about how well received this movie was by critics.
Yes, critics really did like this movie. IMDb currently has it sitting at a 7.2 out of 10, with Rotten Tomatoes at a 69% critics score. And audience is slightly better at 71%. So critics and people in general like this movie, just not enough people saw it when they needed to.
Well, you know, and I think part of that was because Disney released a movie against itself, because they released Santa Claus, one of the ones, I can't remember which ones, but against it.
There was also Eight Crazy Nights opened up this at the same time as well, which is another beautifully animated film. It's not particularly a good one, but it is gorgeous to look at.
Yeah, but it's also seasonal, because it was released sort of as that pre-Christmas release. So when you take something like a pirate movie, put it up against seasonal films right before Christmas, you're kind of setting it up for failure in a way.
Especially also because it came out the same year as Lilo and Stitch. And regardless of what you say about how they marketed Treasure Planet, Lilo and Stitch had one of the more memorable marketing campaigns for a Disney movie. And to release them in the same year, riding on the coattails of a movie that had a lot of really good buzz, maybe not the best choice. And yeah. also the fact that, as Sam said, they released it against Santa Claus 2. And also there was a survey that was done that I actually found this morning where there was a lot of people who were polled. I can't remember the sample size at the time by Disney in terms of why they didn't see Treasure Planet in the theater. And the number one answer was because they were waiting for the home video release. And it's because Disney had basically just fallen into this routine of releasing a movie in the theater, releasing it on DVD 3 to 6 months later. And people got wise to that and stopped going to their movies as much as seems like what happened for Treasure Planet a little bit.
I can say that about most movies in general now, because the turnaround between Blu-ray, DVD, or even VOD is 2 to 3 months now.
Yeah.
Well, before all the chaos, but I just like, home theater's really good at this point. I don't have to deal with people coughing and sneezing and kicking the back of my seat. And I'd go to the movies far less than I used to, because it turns around really quick. And like I tell most people, like when they look at me funny, well, you didn't go see the latest Marvel movie the first week. I'm like, it's not a race.
Well, I think with the especially Disney movies, and actually at that time, one of the main problems was, is again, they're saying, I'm going to wait for the DVD to come out. I think what a lot of people did is they just automatically waited for the DVD and bought it because of the Disney vault. Because they're like, if I don't buy this now, I will never get it until they just decide to do it at some random time.
And if you look at the Disney vault, the stuff that didn't do that well, like Black Cauldron and this, and there's a few, and they're very rarely re-released from the vault. I mean, now it's all accessible on Disney Plus, but before Disney Plus, those re-releases were very far apart, far more than like the Bambis and the Sleeping Beauties and whatnot. So,
yeah.
Well, and I think the other thing about this movie that made it hard to sort of to get interested in, is there's nothing in this movie that to sort of grab onto in terms of a character. Like with Lilo and Stitch, you have Stitch, right? It's like, oh, Stitch is really fun and cool and interesting, and it's the lead character. Our cute comes from Morph, and it's really hard to grab onto Morph.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So there's that. There's nothing there that sort of like for the kids.
Well, I think that's where Ben was supposed to be, but he comes in so late.
He comes in so late, and he's not cuddly.
No, he's obnoxious.
And you know what?
Yeah.
At the time, too, Ben was in every trailer. Like, almost every scene where Ben yells was in somewhere in a trailer for Treasure Planet. He was very marketed in that movie.
You get the feeling that they couldn't get Robin Williams, so they got Martin Short. Like, it really felt like it was written for Robin Williams.
Yes. I could see that.
Yeah. Tell your friends, tell your family about the show. Make sure they get their
earballs
on the show by just recommending it. We're everywhere. We're iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and so many more. Even freaking YouTube. So there's no excuse. Just pass it on and let everybody know that the invasion has begun. Well, we're the invasion has been going for like 4.5 years, guys. So help spread the word. When you see us post on our social media, share it out on your own walls for your own people to see, and hopefully we get some more earballs on that show. And we also have a couple central hubs, of course, our Libsyn site, invasionoftheremake.libsyn.com, and our Wix site. Sam, what is the address to that Wix site?
It is invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast. Go there.
He worked hard on getting that up. And of course, like I said, you can communicate with us directly. Usually it's myself answering the emails and Facebook, and Sam's usually the Twitter guy. So you can talk to us directly, and we'll talk back to you nicely sometimes.
Unless
you're a dick first, then we might not be so nice. But we like to have a nice fun community here, so leave some positive ratings and reviews while you're listening to the show, and we'll catch you next week as we do a comparison, or I have something else on mind. I don't share yet. Find out. Tune in next week. Until then, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
I continue to be Trish,
and I always return as Jeff Omega.
Oh, see, it flowed better. It was just all screwed up when Sam wasn't here last week. There was like, I did my thing, and then there was silence as they were waiting for Sam to talk, who wasn't here the entire episode. And I left it all in.
And then I didn't know when to come in, and I'm like, should we just move Jeff to the middle? It's very confusing, Sam, when you're not here.
Well, I try to avoid it, but sometimes it's unavoidable.
Okay, guys, we are out of here.
It wasn't your fault, you know.
Why, half the crew would be spinning in that black abyss if not
for... Don't you get it? I screwed up. I mean, for 2 seconds, I thought that maybe I could do something right, but... I just... just forget it. Forget it.
Now, you listen to me, James Hawkins. You got the makings of greatness in you, but you gotta take the helm and charge your own course. Stick to it, no matter the squalls. And when the time comes, you get the chance to really test the cut of your sails and show what you're made of. Well, I hope I'm there, catching some of the light coming off you that day.